Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Let me tell you a little bit about our introducer, who doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'll do it anyhow, Larry Heineman, who is he's not a Chicago writer, but he's a writer from Chicago, whose books I think most of you are familiar with, but I will go over this a little bit. His novels include Close Quarters, Paco's Story, and Cooler by the Lake. His short stories and nonfiction have appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, Penthouse, Tri-Quarterly, and many, many, many other publications. He has been the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Illinois Arts Council, and is a recipient of the National Book Award, the Carl Sandburg Award, the Vietnam Veterans of America Award, and the Society of Midland Authors Award. So you could say he's an award-winning author for sure. He's currently working on a very exciting book, train travel book, about his recent return trips to Vietnam, which will be published by Harcourt, Brace and Company. So without any further ado, let me introduce Larry Heineman. And by the way, Ms. Kingston will be signing books afterward in the lobby. Larry?
Hello and welcome. This may sound like a lot, but it really isn't. I'll keep it short and sweet. Tonight, last but not least, Maxine Hong Kingston. Let me first give you the morning line. She's the author of Woman Warrior, China Men, Tripmaster Monkey, and most recently a reissue of a book she did a number of years ago called Hawaii One Summer, which is now being republished by the University of Hawaii Press. She is the recipient of the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, the Penn International Penn West Award for Fiction, and the President's Humanities Medal. She has been designated a living treasure by the state of Hawaii. As we say on my block, a genuine big potato. Maxine is a senior lecturer of creative writing at the University of California in Berkeley, but that is only her job. Her work is as a storyteller. Now, let me tell you a quick story to illustrate my understanding of her writing. 2 years ago, my son and I accompanied Maxine and a number of other writers and poets on a trip to Vietnam. And it was her first trip there. And among the things I wanted to show Maxine and the others was the sunrise at China Beach, which you may have heard of. At 5 a.m., Maxine and Lee Swenson, a good friend of ours, my son and I walked down to the water. The beach extends for miles in every direction. The sun comes up like a big, fat fire, the kind of light that makes you glad that you are alive. Lee and I stand in the water to our knees. Preston, my son, takes off, pounds into the water as far as his legs will carry him, dives in, disappears, and sails out as far as one breath will take him, and then starts swimming toward California. Behind us, barefoot and dressed in her swimsuit, we're all in swimsuits. My son's in a swimsuit, too. Behind us, Maxine is hopping, skipping, and jumping, windmilling her arms, and whooping at the top of her lungs. And I have to tell you that just that moment, and I know this may sound odd, but give me a moment here. It seems like an awful stretch, but it does make sense. At that moment, I thought of what Cochise once said at a palaver. Cochise was a Chiricahua Apache chief. The introductions are made, and before anyone else says a word, Cochise stands up and he looks right at the colonel and he says, "You must speak straight to us so that your words may go like sunlight to our hearts." And it struck me then that Maxine's writing is like that. In other words, Maxine is a writer's writer, whatever anybody else may think of her. Her writing gives off heat as well as light. She is that rare craftsman who sees the world with a clean eye of the artist and tells our human story with a robust and elegant voice from here, where the Chinese say the qi resides. In other words, diminutive and indomitable, indefatigable and calm, at ease always, and probably most important, spiritually powerful, never astonished at the goodness of anyone. So please welcome one of creation's living treasures, Maxine Hong Kingston and the Fifth Book of Peace.
Oh, thank you, Larry. That was a loving and beautiful introduction. Thank you very much. I have been working on a book, the Fifth Book of Peace, and this is, I am going to read you something that I am working on right now so that you can see how this creation takes place. A long time ago in ancient China, there were three books of peace. And if you've ever heard any mention of them, they would be called the three lost books of peace. And probably they existed at the beginning of Chinese history. And it has been a tradition in China that whenever a new regime takes over, the new rulers will burn the libraries and burn the books and kill the historians and then start history all over again and rewrite history. And this custom occurs even in modern times. When you think that during the Cultural Revolution, there were the destruction of museums and universities and libraries. And that happened in Tibet, too, when 6,000 temples were burned in Tibet. You can also think of it as 6,000 libraries. Meanwhile, the books of war are extant, and they are powerful. They have been translated in languages all over the world and translated into English in many editions and used in military academies. And, you know, that makes you think about the state of our world and literature when the books of peace are gone and lost, and the books of war are alive. I had been thinking about this for many years, and I thought, well, I would try to find the books of peace. And so whenever I've been to Asia, I would ask scholars, and I would ask students, or anybody that I met, cultural ministers. I've asked two Chinese cultural ministers to help me look for those books. And whenever I met any students or scholars or travelers to China, I would ask people to look for the books. And I have never found them, and nobody has any information. And so I finally thought that if those books were going to live, it would be up to me to write a book of peace. And I imagine that what I would have to do is to write stories that have peaceful outcomes. People would use peace tactics in order to end wars or to and to find peace within themselves and also socially out in the world. So I was working on this book of peace for years, and I was thinking about, I was imagining characters who would be strong pacifists, and situations in which the plot would culminate in peace rather than violence. And so I've been working for about 2 years, and I had 250 or so well-written, rewritten, polished pages. And then the firestorm came through Oakland and Berkeley and burned an area that's 3 by 4 miles, square miles, and burned 3,000 houses and killed 25 people. And we lost our house and lost my book of peace. So that book burned in the fire. And afterwards, I thought about how I would write the book of peace again. So this is why the book that burned, I think of that as the fourth book of peace. And then, so this one is the fifth book of peace, and that's how I got its title. It wasn't a matter of just thinking I couldn't just retrieve the book that was burned. It wasn't a matter of trying to remember what it was, word for word. In fact, I had a student, an English major, who became a hypnotherapist. And he took a 6-week course in hypnotherapy. And then he advertised on milk cartons. And so he offered to hypnotize me. And he said that I could remember, I could think about what the computer screen looked like. I could see my book scrolling up, and I could read it onto a tape recorder, and then we transcribe it, and there it is. And his plan was really scary to me because I thought I could get stuck in that draft. And, you know, because writing is a process of discovery. Writing is always going into the new and finding the next thing and imagining what isn't so. And it's not enjoyable if it's just remembering. And so I didn't go for that plan. But I did suggest that he hypnotize me, and then I could just go on some journey and find what we could find. And we saw many things. One of the things was arriving at a river and and there was a glass vial that was in the shape of a heart. And I picked it up and scooped out the water from the river and brought it back. And imagine the house that was burned and the room where I was creating the stories. And I took the vial of water and poured it all over the computer and my papers, and also a redwood tree that I had brought back from the forest, and a spotted owl that was in the tree. I poured the water and the light all over it. And the characters in the fourth book of Peace appeared, and I poured water all over them, and they were shining. And they invited me to come back to this place and talk to them whenever I had questions about the fifth book of Peace that was going to write. The first section of the fifth book of Peace is about my going through the fire. And I snuck in past the police lines in order to try to reach the house. And I planned to run inside and take a deep breath and run in there and grab my 250 pages and run out. And I also thought if I had time, I would get my mother's jewelry, and then I would grab my father's draft card, because I had my father's draft card, and I was going to try to save that. And it turned out that it was all gone by the time I got there. See, when I talk about the fire, I have to get some water. So I got there and just saw land that was utterly changed. I couldn't even recognize. There were no landmarks because everything was burned. And later, talking to veterans of war, talking to people who had been at Hiroshima or Nagasaki or in Dresden, people said, this is what a bombed out area looks like. This is what happens after the bomb has fallen, and this is what happens after a firefight. The land looks like this. In fact, James Jones did a beautiful description of flying over Wei after bombings. And everything is black and white and gray. There are no colors. Color disappears. Nothing but maybe a piece of wire sticking up and to show what that was. So the first book of part of the book is called Fire, and I describe what things look like after a fire, after a bombing. Then the second part of the book is called Water, and I felt that I needed to write a water imagery, and I needed that for my body and my psyche, and I needed to write an extended eulogy to the planet, which is made out of water. And the second part of the book is fiction, and the first part is nonfiction, you know, actual fires. So second book part is fiction, and I use my the same characters that I have in Tripmaster Monkey. Whitman Ossing leaves for Hawaii, a land that's mostly water. And he is a draft dodger. And his fantasy is to go into the Pacific the same way that Gao Gan did. Where Gao Gan leaves, he leaves the old world, and he heads off to make a life of the artist in Tahiti. But the difference between Gauguin and Whitman is that Whitman has to figure out a way to do it with his wife and child. Gauguin leaves his wife and his children in order to lead the free life. And so the problem I set up here is, can you leave for the Pacific with your wife and child? And how do you do that? How can you lead a free life if you have a family and you mean to commit yourself to this family? I'm going to read to you a scene where Whitman, you know, he gets there to the island, and he's got his wife and family, but then he still wants to keep going, so he starts, he's hitchhiking around the island. And he is picked up by some drivers, and they are black men who are pick up this hitchhiker. And so he, Whitman is very, he has a very romantic view about black people. You know, they know where it's at. They are the people who just are completing the amazing civil rights movement. And so they pick him up in this car. He says, "Are you military guys?" Both of them had short afros like soldiers. "The few black people in the islands are military." "The Army of the Lord," said Clifton. "Oh no, fallen among the religious again. The island is full of Christians." "We're Vista Volunteers," said Sheraton, "sponsored by our Methodist church." The Vista is the Volunteers in Service to America, and they were the domestic Peace Corps. "Missionaries from the government and the church. The missionaries are still coming. And now they're black. Say one word toward converting me, I'm getting off." Sheraton said, we're on our way to Kahalu, the poorest area in the United States. We just came from the airport. This is our first day in Hawaii." "Me too," said Whitman. "We're on the same life path and route. I flew in yesterday. This is my first full day here, and I live in Kahalu. I'm on my way back there now. What a small world. My Karass, brothers of the open road. What a great way to evade the draft. You've got it made. What a smart plan, covering all the bases. The religious exemption and the indispensable service exemption. Vista workers get deferred and exempted like Peace Corps, right?" "I haven't been planning like that," said Sheraton, who was turned around in the seat, listening to Whitman. "How about you, Clift? You have motives like that?" Clifton didn't answer, a shudder in his wide-open eyes looking at Whitman via the rearview mirror closed. Shields and Sheraton's eyes also slammed down. How do they do that? Whitman blurted and blabbed out his secret. "I'm a draft dodger myself, on the lam and underground. I read The Conquest of Violence by Joan Bondurant. That's Martin Luther King's favorite book. Have you read The Conquest of Violence?" No, they hadn't read it. They're probably the kind who don't read but the one book, the Bible. Vista trained us in organizing," said Sheraton. "I believe in organizing for power. We're going to organize the poverty out of Kahalu. The people of Kahalu have a valuable resource, one another. Organized, they pool and multiply their talent and wealth. Together, they'll think of what they want. They're in want, but when they know their wants, they'll begin to create fulfillment. Once a person learns organizational skills, he'll be able to live anywhere, a slum, suburbia, jail. I expect to be happy living in Kahalu." He was admitting to happiness, unheard of during this era of alienation and depression. "By organizing everybody, I can make any place, public housing, a corporate office, any job, a city block, a viable home place. When I learned my organizing, I stopped being lonely and afraid. I will never have to live alone, get old alone, die alone. I won't be a lonely old man in an old age home. I'll just organize the coots and geezers. Clifton, the driver, said, I'm not a draft evader. I'm a draft dodger. I'm not a draft dodger. I don't believe in dodging and evading. I'm a draft resister. He looked Whitman eye to eye in the rearview mirror. Do you get the difference? I keep my draft board informed exactly where I am and what I'm doing. My every activity on the outside of the Army is political activity. Everything I do, I'm resisting. I'm practicing for my confrontation day with the Army. I look forward to it. I'm not evading it. When my number comes up, I'm going straight down to my induction center. They'll call out my name, Clifton Anderson. That's a crucial moment when they call out your name. You're supposed to take one step forward. That one step is a very symbolic step. It means that you are volunteering of your own free will, even if you've been drafted. You're assenting. You're a soldier. You're obeying your first order. I will not to take that step. I resist. I'm practicing not to take that step. My telling you about it right now is practice. I think about not taking that step. I am developing a resistant state of mind. Advanced preparation of mind and body will keep me from stepping forward. I'm not going to automatically, unthinkingly stick my foot out there. Everybody else will step forward. So I naturally will want to step forward too. But when they call my name, I'll stand still. I've been having friends say, Clifton Anderson. And I stand there. I don't move my feet. Whenever I hear my name called out, I freeze. You take a step, and that's the step that takes you from walking the walk of a free man to walking the walk of a government issue. When they don't see me step forward, they'll call my name again, several times to make sure I heard. They may try to coax me or ridicule me or threaten me, but I'm forewarned and prepared. I will not step forward. Then they'll see that I heard my name, but I'm purposefully not stepping forward, and they'll arrest me. They could jail me then and there, or they could dangle me, send me home for 2 weeks or an indefinite time. I know a guy who didn't hear from them for 9 months. They want you to stew over the possible consequences. A lot of people can't take the suspense. They'll leave for Canada, or they'll induct themselves. Me, I'm withstanding the pressure. I'm resisting. They'll call me up again. I'll resist some more. I'm resisting evil. In times of evil, resist evil, even if you have no hope to stop it. Shelton chorused with him, in times of evil, resist evil, even if you have no hope to stop it. That is the motto of the resistance, and was first said by Robert McAvey Brown, chaplain at Stanford. So, multicultural Whitman rode through Honolulu with two idealistic black men of average build. Every time he meets actual black people, they're the mild-mannered kind. Never the super macho, jive-talking criminals or crime fighters. Big black men you see in the news and the movies. It must happen the circles he runs in. They aren't any more hip and cool than he is. He came from a jazzy city, and they're Midwest church people. They're Methodists and have methods for improving the world. When he gets to know them better, he'll ask them about soul. What is soul exactly? And do they detect his? And blood Am I blood? They were going to Kahalu over the top of the Pali. You guys wouldn't happen to have a bologna sandwich or ham sandwich in the car, would you? No pork products? Cold cuts? Carrying any pig? Whitman passed on the lore of this ground. A car that carries pork will break down and not make it over the Pali. It so happened that they did have some salami sandwiches. Trickwise Whitman advised against eating them. They'd be carrying pork in their stomachs. Clifton turned off for the Pali lookout, where he parked next to a mahalo can. But none of them could throw away food. They walked to the bronze plaque in the mountainside that commemorates King Kamehameha of the Big Island, pushing the army of Oahu over the Pali lookout. Sherrington put the sandwiches on a rock for a poor, hungry person. The newcomers began their time in Hawaii, respectfully heeding the talk story of Hawaiians. The least you can do is follow their last request. They were looking over the lookout for a look when a surprise wind blew upward out of the cliff. Wind can come up a mountain and another mountain, and another wind blasted out of the old Pali road. They leaned on the wind without falling. It held them up. It spun them. They laughed in amazement, lying prone and supine on the stable wind. They ran with it and against it. Great invisible creatures wrestled them, roughed them up, and with dexterous fingers unbuttoned their shirts and pulled t-shirts over their heads. Two men with curly nubs of hair on their chests and a man with no hair on his chest played like boys who find themselves in miraculous bodies that leap and run and just about fly. They hung on to their shirts that pulled them sailing. Head down, arm out, they ran for touchdowns into the wind, through the wind tunnel and onto the old Pali road. The air went still. The cantilevered road wound along the face of the mountain and bent out of sight. Boulders had fallen and broken the cobblestones and tar pavement. Through cracks and holes, you could see the depth of the valley under your feet. And before you, as you stood at the low wall, was the windward side and the ocean. Kings and queens on horseback and carriages and palanquins had traveled this road to and from their summer palaces. Chinese must have built this road. Look up the history of any hard-made road. The Chinese built it. The road curved through Noa, green and yellow guava, torched ginger, yellow and white ginger aflutter with yellow and white butterflies. At the inside wall grew Job's tears and buffalo grass. Good thing nobody leapt over that wall to take a piss. You would fall through the space between wall and mountain down into the valley far, far below. No kapu signs, no upkeep. Look out for yourself. In a wide curve of the outside wall, crumbling at this spot, was years of spray paint graffiti. I was here. Fock. Lover's initials. Love. The hikers climbed over the wall where it sat terraced on the mountain. A tree pointed them up an arroyo lined with red torch ginger and plumerium. They followed a graceful stream, almost a waterfall, and drank from it. They took a chance with the water and joined their health and fate to that of the Kama Aina. Life burgeoned everywhere, no crack of empty space. Move aside branches, there's grasses, and behind and within grasses and leaves, bugs, mosses, life forever under and inside rocks in the dirt and mud. They found a big round metal thing that was the nose of an airplane, and next to it a piece of wing and a propeller blade and a rotary and axle. An airplane had crashed up here, maybe shot down in World War II, but any rising sun insignia had rusted off. They picked up still elegant gears and considered each taking a piece of the airplane for souvenirs. But respect Kapu. Travel light, bad luck, history. Treat this place like a national park where it's against the law to carry away anything. They left the reminders of death and war. They turned about and went down along the stream back the way they'd come. They went through the twisty winds and stood at the lookout between the old Pali road and a pinnacle that swooped upward like an Eva's wing, and ahead a 180-degree view of the other side of Oahu, the Pacific Ocean, Kaneohe, Chinaman's Hat, Kahalu, their new home, Kahalu, Waimanalo, Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station. The upshooting wind would die down and shoot up again. If you ask around, you surely hear a talk story that you can't kill yourself here because the wind will blow you back up. Thank you. The interaction of this book is always the energy of human beings and the energy of nature. Where does war and violence come from? Could it just be another windstorm or firestorm inside of our souls and in our minds? And are we just carrying out not just policies of our government, but are we just carrying out some of the forces of nature? And do they blow through human beings the way that they blow through the landscape? And is there any escape? Here they go into nature, you know, this beautiful island. And what do they find? Not only the land, but also this plane that crashed there during a war a half a century ago. As Whitman and his wife Tanya come into a new culture, into this new land of Hawaii, how do you deal with this new kind of nature and also these very foreign people that are there, and you are the outsiders and you see this place for the first time? Tanya is an artist. She's a painter. And so she comes to the new island, to this new world, with her skills as an artist. She sets up a studio an outdoor studio on the lanai of their house. A reason for having the lanai studio was to insist that we live in the kind of society that does not steal, to live trusting and unparanoid. Our hearts and house are open, and the world is good. Tanya became the odd, bountiful white lady who shows up amongst poor children and pays attention to them, gives them things, invites them into her home, and shows them marvels. It can change their lives. Her palette arrayed rich browns and the colors that make up brown, purples and reds, lit with yellows and oranges and greens. She mixed Hawaiian skin colors and talked to the girls she painted. "Your face is a different color and tone from your arm. See?" She wanted to show them their beauty in specific detail. "More red in your face, rose and orange, and blue in your lips, and coral in her lips, and yellow on your arm. Do you see it? You have to really look, and you'll see. There are many, many colors in your face, Your cheeks and chin are a different color, and it keeps changing in the shadow and the lights. The skin on your face is different on your forehead and around your eyes, and different on your nose and the wings of your nose, which stand out in planes. If you put color here and here and here, it's the same when you're wearing makeup. A dab of red in the middle of your upper lip and lower lip, and your chin and your cheeks and eyelids and forehead and nose. Your features stand out. Your face has many planes, no flat face. Oh, your face is a beautiful color. Ah, you are beautiful. You have so many expressions. Your feelings change the colors too. Giving teenage girls cosmetic hints can keep them out of the wax, which recruited with promises of makeup and makeover classes. See how many colors go into making skin color. Even a howly face, which is not chalky, beigey pink like the flesh crayon. As I am writing this book, I am constantly thinking about the forces of destruction and creation. Forces of destruction destroyed a book of peace, four books of peace. And so how do I create again? How do all of us create? I quote Rilke in this book. Rilke says, "I know that nothing has ever been real without my beholding it. All becoming has needed me. My looking ripens things, and they come towards me to meet and be met." Somehow being able to create a work of art or to create a world, we have to be able to see it, behold it, and then we will be able to make not only a work of art, but a world. And a peaceful world is to make something from nothing. Hawaii is the place it is, exists because of the preconceptions and ongoing perceptions that everyone has of her. The Aina is the spirit of the land and the land, which is also its people, the Kama Aina. Mind makes everything. The Aina, the war, everything. Hawaii, a small, manageable size, ought to be easily affected and effected. Manipulate the Dharmakaya. See the world peacefully, and the war will end. Hawaii is a place of wind and water. And all the time that we were living there, the wind would constantly blow, and we would keep saying that it's blowing all the IQ points out of our heads. How can you think when you are in a place like that? How can you think when the water and the air is so sensuous and sexy? You become all body. And so how can you think and write? Surprises kept breaking Whitman out of any solipsism. On the windward side, always rainy season, it rained and rained and rained. Cane-tapping rain, tarot-tapping rain, leaf-bruising rain, flower-spoiling rain, face-touching rain. They have military rains here. Bullet rain. Rain that marches like American soldiers. Rain that attacks like American soldiers. Rain like the feet of soldiers forming a rainbow pattern. A bad rainstorm, dishonorable discharge. The thuds and thumps and dreams and awake were rains of coconuts on the roof. masculine reigns, feminine reigns, sexy reigns. Sex comes raining down, rain that goes upward, rain that makes you drunk, rain of enthusiasm and might and main, merciful rain, like in Shakespeare. Rain that sneaks along as if going out of the way to avoid an acquaintance. Torrent like a crowd of people rushing to the movies. The Texas sage rain. Weeping and tearful rain like a child's tears. Rain on the fire. When the sun came out at the same time, it made rainbow rain in the footsteps of the high chief, and rainbow rain that is God's footsteps. Showers follow one another like members of a chief's retinue. An eye flutter, an eyelid flutters. It's going to rain. Tanya drew the rain in graphite lines of gray, shades of darker gray that were the Koalau's, cross hatches of rain, blew one way and blew the other way. Layers of rain, rain on land, rain on ocean. She was drawing the dark rain like a new house before it has been made. In the old days, houses were made of grasses. She let the rain run the watercolors and inks to capture nature. Mainland people get depressed in rainy weather until they can discern the rains. Rain drums steadily on the great curving leaves, echo chambers, amplifiers. A rain could last for days and nights, weeks. You lost track. Time and thoughts wash away. Why so much tattooing in Oceania? To mark notes on your very skin so you can know what is you. To pin yourself down in the air and wind, to make yourself vivid so you don't wash away. Stay conscious. There was a problem being conscious during Vietnam, the long American war. People cut or drew a C on the back of their hands. C for consciousness. Stay consciousness. Consciousness is a responsibility. Time to read one more short piece.
Please.
A very short scene of Whitman contending with water. Remember, in order to save myself from fire, I write a water chapter. But then you get into water, and then it gives you another set of problems. Black Pete had invited Whitman. I was working on this water chapter right next to Lake Como. I'm just flying from Italy. We spent a month at Lake Como where there's this retreat for scholars and writers. And basically they feed you wine and dine you and make your bed and just take care of you, and all you have to do is write. And so it was really nice to be right next to a body of water while I was writing about this water. But flying back, I just lost my voice. Black Pete had invited Whitman from the first day to try entering the ocean, to dive deeply into Hawaii. One day Whitman took Black Pete up on his invitation. In duck fins, they walked backwards into the tide. They spat into their masks with their own personal spit to keep them from fogging up, and fitted the mask over their faces. You push your hair out of the mask so it seals tight. Whitman lay in the water and saw the sea floor, breathing through the snorkel, swimming and poling himself along with his Hawaiian sling. He followed the steady blue flippers ahead of him. The Hawaiian sling works like a crossbow, but with a spear about 8 feet long. You pull the elastic tube band back to a hook, and it's loaded. Shoot by squeezing the long trigger with your whole hand. the spear springs out. It is connected to the rest of the sling with a rope so you could retrieve it and the fish. I think I'm just going to have trouble reading this. So I'm thinking, maybe Earl, you could come up and read this. Okay. Earl's pointing to Larry. Earl is my husband, and this actually happened to him. So I thought maybe since it actually happened to him.
I'll just go back. Okay. I'll just go back to the, the top. Black Pete had invited Whitman from the first day to try entering the ocean, to dive deeply into Hawaii. One day he took him up on it. In duck fins, they walked backwards into the tide. They spat into their masks with their own personal spit to keep them from fog up, and fitted the masks over their faces. You push your hair out of the mask so it seals tight. Whitman lay in the water and saw the sea floor. Breathing through the snorkel, swimming and poling himself along with his Hawaiian sling, he followed the steady blue flippers ahead of him. The Hawaiian sling works like a crossbow with a spear about 8 feet long. You pull the elastic tube band back to a hook and it's loaded. Shoot by squeezing the long trigger with your whole hand, the spear springs out. It is connected to the rest of the sling with a rope, so you can retrieve it and the fish. Black Pete's large brown self with the kicking blue feet, his underheel is white, was just ahead. Whitman was inside his flying dream again, flying over forests and mountains and over deserts and between and amongst fish. Schools of tilapia turned and flashed in the sunny currents. A sea turtle stroked by. Whitman wanted to exclaim over it and talk about it. Sea cucumbers rocked on the bottom. There were climates, gold sand falling and sparkling all around, and sudden, cool, shadowy darknesses. The swimmers entered and left blue-gray rooms and green chambers. He heard sounds as if many people were speaking in a foreign language. Voices were trying to talk to him, or they were talking about him. They were behind his right ear, and he could almost make out what exact words they were saying. Being a conversationalist, he wanted to ask, "What?" and to answer those talkers. He flipped over to his back, saw sky and clouds, and shouted, "Hey, Pete, this is great, terrific. Did you see the turtle?" Pete kept going, and Whitman swam to catch up with him. The voices were the sound of his own breathing through the snorkel. He held his breath, and the voices changed, sounds of his blood pulsing, sounds of his mind. The reef was like the Sierras, and then fish swam across his view. A school of silver-gray fish streamed by. Pete followed them, and Whitman followed him. This is hunting. Multitudes of life lived in the reef. Zebrafish, yellow tangs, angelfish. The creatures moved quickly away or drifted slowly away. A blowfish came toward him, blew up round and spiny and squirted away. Our human relationship to other creatures, we try to get close to them and they recede. We're always catching up to them and they move away. We have to shoot them to get them to stay still. Another puffer came right at Whitman, looked at him out of round eyes, and made an O round mouth, and puffed itself up into a spiny round ball, a target. Whitman shot it in its side when it turned about. Black Pete worked it off the spear and put it in his bag, laughing at the puny catch. Black Pete pointed out holes, pukas, in the reef. He gave instructions on how to catch lobsters. "You see the kind antennas, the feelers stick out of the coral. Lobster cooperate with moray eel and with you. Lobster give you warning. You see one feeler in, one feeler out. Moray eel inside the puka, living in there with the lobster. Two feelers out, eel not home. You reach in and grab the lobster." One deep breath, and down they dove. Sure enough, antennae hairs sticking out from the puka. And that puka, oh, the delicacy, the aliveness of nature. Life sensitive to life, creatures sending out feelers into the universe to contact one another. Black Pete reached into a puka and pulled out a lobster. Then sudden churning horror and violence. Moray eel, worm Ouroboros, big open mouth, in pointy teeth, squinty black eyes came shooting out after the black hand, gripping the lobster, its cave mate, its symbiotic treasure. Slithering, ribboning yards of eel flowed outward and upward, tail more and more of it still within the coral cave and its head about to bite Black Pete's hand. Whitman came in close. The Hawaiian sling has short range, rope not long. He put the spear tip on the eel and shot. This moray eel will be the second creature, not counting insects, that he has killed, and he didn't even have to kill it. Black Pete had swum out of harm's way for air. He hit it. He felt the spear go through flesh, but it didn't die. The moray eel crawled and curled and twisted up the spear and the rope at him, eyes looking at him and mouth open to eat him up. It was climbing out of the knot of itself, twisting up the spear, up the rope. Whitman dropped the entire apparatus and popped out of the water.